Hey, it's Michelle Beadle. That's right, the Michelle Beadle. You're welcome. You love talking about sports. I love talking about sports. You know the only thing cooler than talking about sports? Sports! And right now, all your favorite sports are on SiriusXM. I'm talking every NFL game, every game from the NBA, NHL, MLB, every NASCAR race, golf major, major conference college sports, and all the top games in the WNBA. If it gets your heart pumping, it's on SiriusXM. To start your free trial of SiriusXM today, visit SiriusXM.com/believe.
Welcome to the San Jose Hockey Now podcast. I'm Sheng Peng, editor-in-chief of San Jose Hockey Now. Also, you can find my work at MEC Sharks and on Twitter at Sheng_Peng. Also, too, we're on Instagram. So find us on Instagram at San Jose Hockey Now.
And I'm Keegan McNally. You can find me on Twitter at halfwall_hockey or halfdashwallhockey.com. Lots of dashes and underscores there. Writer for San Jose Hockey Now and the co-host of the San Jose Hockey Now podcast.
Before we jump into the breaking news or whatever's going on in the world of the Sharks right now, I wanted to preview our guest. We have an exciting guest today, Michael Santos. If you don't know him, Michael has a wealth of NHL front office experience stretching back from 1997 to 2014. He was part of the New York Islanders, Florida Panthers, and Nashville Predators front offices. And so anyway, I'm bringing Michael on because I wanted to get a front office perspective on what concerns do you have as a team about bringing back a player who doesn't want to be here? And of course, we're talking about Erik Karlsson, and that's sort of going to be the focus of our conversation today. What concerns do you have about bringing Erik Karlsson back to the San Jose Sharks? I know a lot of fans not happy with sort of the trade proposals that they're hearing out there, whether it be it from me or in general from guys like Elliot Friedman, Frank Saravalli, like just sort of what's out there for the Sharks doesn't sound like a lot. So a lot of fans say, just bring Erik back. And so let's talk about sort of the historical examples and the implications of bringing a player back who doesn't want to be here. Also, too, Santos shares a couple of really interesting slices of hockey history. The Islanders, who he was an AGM at the time, wanted the number two pick in the 1997 draft. That's the Joe Thornton, Patrick Marleau draft. Of course, the Sharks drafted Marleau number two. The Islanders had picks number four and five in that draft. They drafted Roberto Luongo and then Erik Brewer. So imagine Roberto Luongo drafted by the Sharks, Patrick Marleau drafted by the Islanders. I don't know, but that's just a fun bit of hockey history that Santos shares. Also, too, he was in the building when the Joe Thornton trade broke in Dallas. So he's going to tell that story. And finally, Mike also tells us about his exciting scouting project, Team 33.
Yep. It's an amazing interview. You guys should stick around for it. For our first segment, we're going to get into a little bit of hockey news. There was probably one of the slowest weeks of the offseason, to be honest.
Yeah, it's going to get slower.
It's going to get a little bit slower until it picks up. But it was definitely a slow week for hockey news. The one bit of news that's kind of Sharks relevant that we're going to talk about, Vladimir Tarasenko, which was one of the biggest free agents still left on the market, three, 4 weeks into free agency, he signed a one-year, $5 million contract in Ottawa just a few days ago or yesterday. And Andy Strickland on Twitter reported that Vladimir Tarasenko had actually turned down a four-year offer from Ottawa at $5.5 million per season earlier on in free agency. And he also had offers from Carolina at $5.25 million for 1 year and San Jose 1 year at $6 million. And it was reported, I think, July 1st, something like that, that the Sharks were interested in Tarasenko.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe a week after, yeah.
Yeah, or a week or so after free agency started, that it was, you know, they were interested. This kind of confirms that they were interested, and it actually gives us a number to talk about as well.
Yeah, and what I find interesting about it is that they, you know, the Sharks clearly wanted to bring Tarasenko in because they offered, it looks like, the most money. And I think that that's a signal that, you know, Mike Greer wants to bring in high-priced talent for the right term, of course. You know, he's not signing anyone to a longer deal, it seems like. But it makes sense for the Sharks. And a lot of people obviously say, well, why would you bring in someone like Tarasenko if you're rebuilding? But you bring in Tarasenko, there's plenty of playing time. He can score a lot. You can flip him at the deadline. It actually makes a lot of sense. You know, it's a good prove-it kind of situation here in San Jose. And so anyway, this shows that the Sharks are in that kind of game. And so I wonder, there's a couple more high-priced sort of free agents out there in defenseman Matt Dumba. Sharks do need somebody to take over on the power play if they manage to trade Carlson this summer. Yep. Or Thomas Tatar, who's a pretty good scoring winger. And so these are two guys that can, you know, pretty easily, you can see them producing in San Jose and then getting flipped at the deadline for a decent pick. And so, yeah, so I'm curious to see if the Sharks are in either of those kind of pursuits, Dumba or Tatar. Also, too, wanted to mention, too, a shout out to a couple of podcasts ago, I think the Will Smith one, where we actually talked with Team 33 about Matt Dumba, and they still like Dumba's game, even though he wasn't as productive last year. So listen to that if you're interested about how Dumba might fit the Sharks.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. It was something that possibly the Sharks could retain the deadline and flip somebody like Leonard Tarasenko.
Yeah, only a one-year contract, so it doesn't hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, so Sharks still have $5.5 million of cap space currently. They had even more before they acquired Anthony Duclair for a little bit more money, Zadina, and I think Kyle Burrows. Basically, they had a little bit more money to play with. They might still have some money to play with coming up, and there might be a few that the Sharks are interested in after Tarasenko ultimately decided not to come to the Sharks.
Right. Right. Just not a lot left out there, though. So I was looking at the list today, and it looks like Dumba and Tatar are only kind of high priced ones out there. So, you know, maybe Tatar might be more medium priced. Other names out there are former big names, but I don't think that they're candidates for kind of a big 1 year contract just because their games aren't maybe quite there anymore. Guys like Paul Stastny, Phil Kessel. But I think that Tatar and Dumba have a bit more upside than those guys. Yeah.
So there wasn't very much Sharks news this week. We did get some New Jersey numbers.
Yeah, Kasper Haltonen, number 14.
It's just something to report.
He's coming to the Sharks, guys.
Yes, this is it. This is the I think it's a possibility that he might be coming to North America. Sure. But we'll see. Yeah.
We talked about that a couple weeks ago.
But other than that, we're going to get into a little bit of Erik Karlsson news. Not like a ton. Just a little bit to try and get us eased into this interview with Mike. But the news has kind of come to a grinding halt in the last couple of weeks. We haven't really been moving forward on the Penguins or the Canes or anything like that. And Shang, you put out a recent article called Sharks Facing Harsh Reality About Carlson's Trade Value.
Fans are loving it.
Very popular with Sharks fans. And people have come up with like their own ideas about what, you know, Erik Karlsson, a superstar, should be worth in this cap world. And it's not kind of jiving in terms of around the league. Karlsson might not be worth that much.
Right.
So let's start there. Let's go over Erik Karlsson's trade value and some ideas about the best way to move Erik Karlsson.
Yeah, a very risky superstar, though, at that. And, you know, I'm personally of the camp. Trade Karlsson, strike while the iron is lukewarm. You know, 33, he's coming off a once-in-a-lifetime season, and he has significant injury history. So I say retain a lot, take the best possible offer.
Yeah, and I think the Sharks should also move on as quick as possible, strike while the iron is lukewarm. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to retain, and that seems like kind of counterproductive because you're not going to get as much for Erik Karlsson if you don't
want to retain something, though. There's no one taking him at 11.5.
Yeah, I just as little as possible. Yeah, anywhere below 2 million is kind of what I would want to do. And if that means that the Sharks don't get that great of a return at all,
or nothing,
which is what Frank Saravalli kind of reported, was that teams aren't really interested even at 9.5 for nothing, or they are. They'll say, yeah,
and sure, they'll give you nothing. Or they'll give you I had a comparison in my article. Marc-Andre Fleury for Mikhail Hakkarainen. And I'm not going to get into that, the too much of the details of that, but basically sure. Marc-Andre Fleury also coming off a trophy. He won a Vezina trophy in the 2020-21 season, but Golden Knights couldn't find anything for him. And so they had to take Mikhail Hakkarainen, who look up his elite prospects. And you can see that the Golden Knights didn't get anything for him.
But I think it's time for the Sharks to move and start a new era in San Jose. And the more money that you have retained on Carlson, especially if you're not getting a whole lot, and it's different if you're getting a lot. And that's kind of like the crux of the argument. But if you're not getting a whole lot, I don't want to have that on books for the next 4 years. I would rather have them start fresh. But that's just my opinion. But a lot of fans are saying, why don't the Sharks just kind of keep Carlson for the next year? So let's
talk and that's sort of the main thing that we're going to talk about right here. You know, fans talk about just keep Carlson until the next trade deadline and hope a projected salary cap dump next off season, you know, opens up the market, which is, you know, this is all possible. It's a very reasonable point of view, even if I don't quite agree with it. But I wanted to dive into it. You know, I talked with a number of league sources just sort of about the implications, once again, of bringing back a guy who doesn't want to be here. And anyway, there are a couple of hangups and risk with bringing back a Carlson. Some obvious and others less obvious. And so that's what we're going to dive into, sort of the positives and or negatives related to keeping Carlson. And so let's get the obvious ones out of the way first, the ones we all know. You know, number one, Erik Karlsson does not want to be here. He wants to go somewhere to win while he's still reasonably productive, which is, I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with him wanting to go somewhere where that team is, you know, focused on winning a Stanley Cup right now. It makes perfect sense. And so I think the question that brings up for me is, what do the Sharks owe Erik Karlsson? And I personally, and I know a lot of fans, I feel like in some ways they're writing out their revenge on Carlson for for really the, you know, disappointing seasons that he had before 2022-23. And so I personally always favor the player. I'm, you know, usually in sort of strikes, lockouts, right? You know, the players are the millionaires, the owners are the billionaires. And so sure. I'm always on the side of the closest thing to the underdog, which is in this case, the millionaires. And so anyway, I don't think that Carlson should take one less penny than his contract owes him. I know some fans suggest that. I think that is crazy. Carlson has, you know, totally earned his sort of the contract that he signed. You know, has he been as good as a contract kind of, you know, suggested or demanded that he be? No, he hasn't been. But when he signed it, he was indeed arguably the best defenseman in the world. So he got a contract that was befitting that. But, you know, what do the Sharks owe him? And I think that is a fair question. Overall, you know, if we compare it to Brent Burns, right? And last year, the Sharks were sort of in the same position with Brent Burns, where Brent Burns wanted to go somewhere where he had a chance to win a Stanley Cup. He, you know, was older. His contract had risked more because of his age. Burns, I'm talking about. But sure. The Sharks took, I think, not the very best offer that they could have got for Burns. But, you know, Burns, obviously, Burns versus Carlson, right? Burns, obviously, played the best years of his life in San Jose. He won a Norris Trophy with the Sharks, was a Norris finalist a couple other times. So, you know, he left the Sharks, you know, leading in virtually every defensive category in terms of productivity, goals, points, all that kind of stuff, right? And so I think most fans would agree that Brent Burns, like, you don't want to kind of do Brent Burns dirty, kind of, you know. He's earned, you know, as quickly as you can expedite it, a somewhere where he wants to play. At least I think both Sharks fans would agree with that. Carlson, I think, yeah, obviously Carlson has, you know, at least half, more than half, less the tenure than Burns. And it's been a very up and down ride with Carlson. You know, going back to last season, you know, Carlson had arguably, he was the least valuable player in NHL if you count his injury history, contract, and age, you know, into everything. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of Sharks fans were disenchanted with Carlson. And so I get that the Sharks don't owe Carlson what I think that they owed Burns. You know, I think that's a fair point of view. I mean, again, I'm all for, you know, player centric.
Reality is that he was brought in for such a high price, and that price continually gets, you know, brought up whenever you talk about Tim Stützle and talk about Josh Norris in Ottawa and how they rebuilt their team already because of the picks and the prospects that we gave them. And we got one Stanley Cup run out of it. Not even a Stanley Cup run.
I would argue one point there, though, that when the trade happened, though, let's not forget that everybody thought the Sharks won that trade.
Oh, yeah, I'm not denying that.
Right. Everyone thought that first-round pick would be, well, that's going to be a late pick because the Sharks didn't protect it. You know, that was the mistake there, you know. Though the Sharks didn't protect it, you know, for I know a good reason. They were trying to Ottawa would have asked for something to protect the pick, basically. And so,
yeah,
you know,
the reality is that the Sharks fans feel like we gave up those things and we got one playoff run. Whereas Burns, we gave up Charlie Coyle, Devin Setoguchi. That's about it. And we got like 10 playoff runs with Brent Burns and one of them went to the Stanley Cup finals.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot more goodwill.
Right.
True. Yeah. A lot of prime Brent Burns, a lot of goodwill towards Burns, where Carlson doesn't get the same goodwill from fans, despite last year being a Norris winner.
Right. And that's fair. You know, I'm not discounting that. Yeah. But so I don't think the Sharks owe what they owe Burns. So, I mean, I do understand if, the Sharks kind of want to hold Carlson a little bit longer, even into the season.
Sure. And there's a significant risk with doing that, right? Like if they hold on to him, there's an injury risk.
That's what I'm worried about. Yeah.
And a performance risk. This was the one year where Carlson, like the reins were taken off and he went with it and he showed he can still be that kind of player, but it could be system dependent. And he did have to sacrifice a lot of his defensive game to do it. So is that going to happen again under David Quinn? Possibly. Or will Carlson also, you know, maybe not perform as well because he's been kind of not performing well for 4 years prior.
Right.
Is it possible he just regresses to a mean that he's, you know, more actually at rather than the superstar level he was last year?
Right. I mean, this is, you can't play down this risk. This is a higher than usual. It's a significant risk. You know, Carlson was hampered by injury and or performance problems in his previous 4 years, you know, before 2022, 23. There's a reason why his trade value is low because teams saw, how great he was last year, but teams also saw how subpar he was for most of the 4 years previous. And so, I think that this is something that, a lot of fans are assuming that Carlson comes back and he's kind of the same, or he is, you know, maybe not like historical, like popping 100 points again, but he's going to be awesome again next year. And that might be the case, you know, and I hope so, because I love watching Erik Karlsson at his best. So great to watch him this past season. So great to watch sort of the flashes that we saw even the previous years in San Jose. But It's a huge, huge, huge risk. And of course, one that I've said many times that I wouldn't take. But let's talk about, you know, taking that risk, right? Even more. And let's talk about sort of the, you know, we talked about the obvious, you know, risk with bringing Carlson back, be it, you know, injury, performance risk. Also, too, you know, what we started off with, you know, that Carlson just doesn't want to be here. But let's talk about the less obvious kind of concerns or risk about bringing Carlson back to the Sharks. And for this one, you know, I reached out to a couple of league sources, agent, multiple front office people. Just I was curious about their thoughts. You know, what do you worry about when you bring back a star player that doesn't want to, you know, be, you know, where he's at? And the agent told me, this was an interesting response, that essentially for a non-playoff team, there's really no concerns. And that could be where that's probably where the Sharks are going to fall. And for a playoff team, the concern more is that, you know, you want everybody to be kind of all in, you know, committed to winning and not about, you know, me or getting out of town. Right. And so that's kind of, so that was that perspective. I talked with an NHL front office person, and what they said was, yeah, you know, possibly the coach, you know, wouldn't want a guy who isn't bought in or who doesn't want to be there, which, you know, makes sense, right? So that's another kind of concern there. I think most of the concerns in this sort of quadrant are, you know, how is this player going to mesh with the locker room? How is the player going to interact, sort of this player interact with just everything going on when he doesn't want to be there? And I think that, you know, speaking about the issue of the coach, right, that David Quinn has been pretty clear, and I believe him, that he would welcome Erik Karlsson back with open arms. And even though the Sharks are not, you know, projected to be a playoff team, and so with that, you know, you still don't want, even for a non-playoff team, you don't want somebody that isn't bought in, that isn't there, kind of isn't engaged. But we'll say though that last year, you know, the Sharks were awful last year, and the Sharks and Karlsson were clearly able to work together well last year. You know, even when it became clear that, you know, Karlsson wanted to bring his elevated play to closer to contending team. Of course, that was last year. Who knows about this year?
Yeah. For what it's worth, Karlsson seems like the kind of guy that's going to compete no matter what. He's, you know, very competitive guy. And sure, he's always talked about wanting to, you know, play the game hard and everything. So it doesn't seem like he wouldn't be happy about it, but he probably would, you know, still perform up to a decent level or his expectations, hopefully. Yeah. And also, for what it's worth, we're about to have on our guest, Michael Santos, who was, like you mentioned earlier, in an NHL front office from 97 to 2014. He also thinks Karlsson is a pro, like a consummate professional who's going to play hard, and that the Sharks and Karlsson would be able to make it work. Just his opinion. There's a little bit of a spoiler there. It's something that the Sharks are going to have to consider as we move closer and closer to the training camp, is maybe Karlsson will be here.
Right. And so I think overall, like, you look at the big picture of it, right? And look, like, I've been pretty clear about how what I think about it, you know, through various articles this off season. But, you know, I'm not ignorant of sort of the upside of all of it. And, Michael will kind of talk about a little bit of that upside too, you know, that there is an upside to this. And looking at it historically, you know, you roll the dice for Karlsson to start the season. If it pans out, for sure, you know, you can be looking at better trade offers on the other side. Look at Alexei Yashin a long time ago in Ottawa. He wanted out of Ottawa. Matt Duchene wanted out of Colorado. And they're good examples of players who wanted out but played another season with their respective teams. Now, comparing Karlsson to Yashin and Duchene isn't a perfect comparison. Yashin was 27 when he was traded from the Sens to the Islanders. Duchene was also 27 when he was traded from the Avs to the Senators. Neither also had the significant injury history that Karlsson has, so just not as much risk there. But because Ottawa kind of stuck to their guns, right, you know, Yashin brought back Zdeno Chara, who's still a prospect at that time, kind of an up-and-comer, but obviously Zdeno Chara blossomed into a Norris-caliber defenseman with the Senators. Also, the draft pick that would become Jason Spezza, I think that was the number two pick of that draft. Duchene got back Samuel Girard and the pick that would become Bowen Byram, you know, both guys that were a big part of their 2022 Stanley Cup. And so I don't think the Sharks are going to get that much for Karlsson. Probably, so I'm not trying to, reverse everything I've said and, like, you know, hold them for, you know, Zdeno Chara and Jason Spezza. You know, I don't think you're going to get that because of, again, age, injury risk, all that kind of stuff, right? So, but if Karlsson is incredible through next season's trade deadline, you will get better offers than you are now. So there is the upside to it. I just don't want people to forget, though, just the significant risk too. This is a significant risk. Don't kid yourself. You know, if you're in the camp of, I'm not going to be happy with just taking one of my proposals recently. I'm not going to be happy with a first round pick, Riker Evans, Justin Schultz, and a third round pick for Carlson and significant retention. If you're not going to be happy with that, that's fine. And you might get a better offer on the other side, but don't discount that. Those are pieces that, you know, first round pick, Riker Evans, those are legitimate pieces that can help you with your rebuild. So, you know, don't ignore what's out there too, and how that can help you, because, you know, you may end up, Carlson may keep improving his trade value for sure, or something can happen, which has happened, you know, once again, with Carlson in most of his recent history. Something can happen and you're stuck with negative value again.
Yeah. And just back to the, you know, like, everything's from a historical lens. Like, it became Jason Spezza, Chara became an all-star defenseman. And then when the Sharks traded for Erik Karlsson, it was, oh man, they got Dylan DeMello and Chris Tierney. Who are those guys? And
yeah, Josh Norris wasn't, yeah.
They considered him a reach at the time anyway. Yeah. And they were like, oh, he didn't even, you know, he's nothing.
And that first round pick is going to be a late.
Yeah, it's going to be a 31st. So they got DeMello and a 31st overall. Like, man, that's terrible. And then, you know, things change.
I think teams have learned from that about not protecting your picks.
I think they, it's going to probably, you know, move forward for a very long time that teams are going to protect it. Teams that are even like 31st in the standings were protecting the Bedard. Yeah, like New Jersey's pick this year was protected for the Sharks.
Right. New Jersey lost every game after they acquired Timo Meier. Well, we better make sure that we don't lose out Connor Bedard.
Yeah, somehow they're like the almost infinitesimally small chance that they would get Connor Bedard in this scenario. But yeah, teams have kind of learned. Anyways, and that's a little bit about the theme of the Michael Santos interview that we did here that you guys are going to hear about in just a second. It's all kind of like a historical, it's all like through a historical lens, it could look different. So this is going to be a very pivotal moment in Sharks history, the trade of Erik Karlsson. The trade for Erik Karlsson was also a pivotal moment, but this is going to be a different type. And we can't judge it right after it happens. It's going to be 4, 5, 6 years from now before we actually
just like the Timo trade.
Exactly. And just like Timo, which people had varied opinions on the return there too. But I think this is a good time. This is going to be kind of a shorter lead in for everybody, because this interview with Mike is very long, very in depth. His information about the Team 33 scouting service is very cool. And I think that's something that's not out there on the internet at all. So I hope you guys enjoy some kind of like behind the scenes look at things and the nitty gritty of scouting, if you will.
From 1997 to 2018, Michael Santos was everywhere and did everything in hockey. He's been assistant general manager with the NHL's New York Islanders and Florida Panthers. He was general manager of the AHL's Rochester Americans and San Antonio Rampage. He was president of the ECHL's Norfolk Admirals. He was also director of hockey operations for the Islanders, Panthers, and Nashville Predators. He's now heading Team 33. He helped found it too. And that's not the 33rd NHL team. Team 33 is an independent scouting service that consults for NHL teams staffed entirely by ex-NHL front office members. Team 33's advisory board features former NHL executives like first Sharks GM Jack Ferreira and Neil Smith. Team 33 also has 21 pro scouts this past season in NHL arenas, including Michel Goulet, Dwayne Sutter, John Van Boxmeer, and the Wild Thing himself, Al Iafrady. So think of Team 33 as adding an entire front office of experience to your NHL team. Michael is now here now to talk about lend his front office insight and experience on everything San Jose Sharks and Erik Karlsson. Welcome to the San Jose Hockey Now podcast, Mike.
Thanks, Shang. It's great to be here with you.
And Mike, I want to hit the ground running here. One of the advantages of Team 33 is you seem to go out of your way to talk to everybody in the league. You're not just confined to your one team. So are you hearing anything about an Erik Karlsson trade?
Oh, I hear everything, but probably all the same things that you hear. you know, obviously he's the marquee name in the marketplace right now. You know, given his talent and given what the Sharks are doing right now in what looks like a rebuild, so they can be very competitive here in the near future. So, I mean, he's the guy out there. I liken him to Damian Lillard in the NBA. You know, he's the prize right now. So somebody somebody's going to have to put together a heck of a package if the Sharks are going to move him on, because the Sharks really need to get a premium for him.
Mm-hmm. And Mike, we're going to get to a little bit more Erik Karlsson trade talk in just a bit, but we're going to go back a little bit. I'm curious about your path to an NHL front office. And then can you share a little bit about your background, how you got into the NHL? Because it seems like it's a very long list of teams there. Is there a shortened version?
Well, I mean, my path was a little different just because the times were different. But essentially, I played the sport growing up. Eventually went to Boston College. I was born in Boston, grew up in Boston, and had a number of roommates in college who all signed NHL contracts. And without a realistic shot at the NHL for myself, it was something that I really wanted to get involved with, and hopefully at the management level. I also had a desire to go to law school while I was in college. And so out of college, had the opportunity to do a full-time internship with the NHL in New York, which led to really exciting projects like creating the NHL All-Star Weekend with a group of folks in New York, such things as the skills competition, not exactly how it exists today, but at least when it was created. And when it was in San Jose back in the 90s, that was a great All-Star event.
Yeah, 0-0 and pointing at Dominik Hasek.
Yes, yes. Yeah, who could forget that? And yeah. And of course, you know, the game itself, we also had the Heroes of Hockey game back then, which the one in San Jose is one of my fondest memories. We actually had a team at that time. The Sharks were still fairly new in the league, so we had a team of former California Seals played against the NHL Hall old timers. So it was a heck of an event that night too.
Go ahead.
No, that's fine. Interrupt.
Sorry about that, Mike. I wanted to also ask you, actually, you mentioned your college roommates who signed NHL contracts. Who were some of your roommates or housemates back then?
I had actually a whole plethora of guys with me that even guys that weren't my roommates that played in the league. Some guys, for instance, one that played for the Sharks for a little bit was Craig Janney.
Oh, you're right.
That I remember.
You're a great playmaker.
Yeah, with the Sharks. Oh, great hands. Some of the best hands I've ever seen. And almost a point-a-game player in the NHL. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that about him. But my immediate roommate was actually Ken Hodges Jr., who played for the Bruins, of course, had 30 goals.
His dad was an NHLer.
Yes, his dad was also a real popular player with Boston back in the 70s. Bob Sweeney, who played, again, also for the Bruins, Calgary, the Islanders. Kevin Stevens, another popular name back in the day with Pittsburgh, among other teams. Doug Brown, who played primarily with Detroit, but also early in his career with New Jersey. There's really a whole list of guys. I think there was 11 or 12 in all that made it to the NHL during my, that I was with during my 4 years of college. So it was interesting group of guys, and really made it a lot of fun for me trying to break into league on the management level. So I spent my years with the NHL. I also worked 2 years in the American Hockey League with the New Haven Nighthawks. Exciting times, because at that time they were owned and affiliated with the Los Angeles Kings. That was just after Gretzky had been traded from Edmonton.
Oh, okay. I see.
So some pretty exciting times there for a couple of years. I went to law school actually while I worked at the NHL. I went to law school in the evening at St. John's University in New York. Nearing the end of my law school, I accepted a position with the Islanders, became the assistant general manager there. Worked primarily with Mike Milbury as the general manager during my time there. And then went on to actually for a year, went with the Florida Panthers the first time I was with them. And then we went into the first work stoppage that actually canceled the NHL season. So at that time, I jumped over and took over the North American Hockey League for 3 years and built that into pretty much what it is now, a national league. And then a person who had worked for me in hockey operations, Mark Frankfeld, has taken it over and done a great job with that league since then. From there, I had interviewed for several positions, a couple of general manager positions, but eventually was offered and accepted a position in Nashville with the Predators, an expansion club. Really enjoyed my time there. Had had a great experience working directly for David Poile, who just retired this year, and what a career he had. And then finished my NHL career to this point with the Florida Panthers as assistant general manager. And then since then, I've been doing a few things. I did take over the Norfolk Admirals for a little more than a year in the ECHL, which was a really interesting experience. I've also been involved in the Eastern Hockey League, which is a Tier 3 junior hockey league in the East Coast. They actually provide quite a few Division 2 and 3 players for college hockey. And in the last 5 years, but particularly the last couple of years, I've been working on this project, Team 33, which is really starting to make some, you know, make some progress now. And we've got a few NHL teams using it. And I think it's a hockey operations management program that'll really help clubs here in the future.
So, Mike, you mentioned the Team 33, the project that you've been developing for the past few years. How did that come about, and what's a little bit more background on that?
Okay, so I have held several positions as an assistant general manager. I tell folks, especially today, I was talking with David Quinn yesterday about this. I like to say, when I was an assistant general manager, there was an assistant general manager. Now teams seem to have four or five of them. And so, in fact, I think the Leafs just hired their fifth one, Derek Clancy. Mm-hmm. But you know, my time was at a premium, and I really had to find ways to do things more efficiently. It was a real busy job. And so I was finding ways to do that. And then during the pandemic, I decided that, you know, I could put all of those different things that I had learned, things that I thought were more efficient and better ways to do things, such as scouting or search for players that fit your needs, make trade proposals, analyze transactions, you know, make good, solid decisions on, you know, who you send to the American Hockey League, who you recall in their place. And so I began working to put it all together into a program that's really a hockey operations management program. It's meant to help particularly executive level employees, such as the general manager, maybe an assistant general manager, even an owner could use this to understand more about what's going on with his or her team. That's really how I position it. It's a hockey operations management program. And if you can imagine, we operate as if we're an NHL club. We have employees that are, you know, experienced NHL people, former NHL general managers, assistant general managers, scouts, coaches, and some folks come and leave year by year because maybe they're employed again by an NHL club in some capacity. For instance, I had Barry Trotz working for Team 33 last year, and now he's, you know, in a general manager's position. I'm sure he would tell you that just in the, you know, in a less than a year that he spent with us, that the program really helped prepare him for the position he's in now as a first-time general manager. So that's, you know, that's really how I position the program. Some of the benefits of it are that the information that we are able to provide is without bias. Mm-hmm. And that may seem like a small thing when you first think about it, but when you're in an organization, it's very easy to become, you know, bias about players, either positively or negatively, you know, perhaps, sure. perhaps the player was drafted from your area as a scout, or mm-hmm. you had a lot to do with making the decision to trade for a particular player. Maybe he's a player that doesn't play well and the coach puts him in the doghouse. So this is a way for the organization to take a step back and see what people that are not in their organization think about their players, their transactions, or potential transactions, or maybe who they can acquire to fill the needs that they have, make their team better.
Because I guess if you had drafted and developed and met with a player, their family over many, many years, you might become biased just from a personal perspective rather than a hockey perspective.
Yeah, you certainly could. You certainly could. So that's definitely a benefit. There's also things that we do differently from my experience working for clubs. Without getting too deep into it, we scout differently. For instance, we put different weights on different attributes because they're not worth the same. I think you'd find that most NHL clubs scout in a way where they rate players on a scale. Maybe it's 1 to 5 or 1 to 10. But the game always changes. And so at different times, different attributes are more important. Like right now, for instance, skating and hockey sense, thinking the game are a premium. And so they shouldn't be given the same weight as physicality, or shootout, those types of things. So those are some of the things we try to do as well. We also offer, in my opinion, we offer better coverage. I mean, the typical NHL team, because of expense, probably more than anything, we'll have 3 or maybe 4 pro scouts, for instance, in North America, covering at minimum the 32 NHL and the 32 AHL teams. So that's if you divide the work up, that could be as many as 20 or so teams that a scout's responsible for. By us having a larger staff, they're more geographically desirable, if you will. And they have the opportunity to see teams that they're responsible for much more. So where an NHL team scout may see a particular team play or player play 6-8 times a season, my guy might see him play 30 times. So we're able to gather more information, and it's less expensive for us to do so.
Your scouts often live where they're scouting, right? That's what it seems like. And that probably saves on a lot of cost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, none of our scouts, or rarely do they have, for instance, an overnight stay or any travel other than by their car. Now, the other thing is, it's really a different game than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago, meaning all the rinks are the same size. All the arenas are beautiful. And I'm sure that maybe the fans at the Shark Tank don't want to hear this. I know the ones in Nashville don't want to hear this, but players really are not intimidated anymore by playing on the road. It's just not the same as it was in 1970 when you had to go into the Boston Garden or the Chicago Stadium, where the rinks were different sizes, teams played different style of games. Even the glass was a different height in some places, or in some places there wasn't any glass behind the visitor's bench. And somebody could grab a hold of your mullet while you were sitting on the bench, and those types of things. it's just changed. So that means that we can get a more fair judgment of a player playing on the road than maybe what would happen in the past, because it's not such a big difference for the player playing on the road as it is playing at home.
And there was an article that was out probably a year ago about Team 33 from The Athletic, where it mentioned that you guys had partnered with the Canadians ahead of the 2022 draft. Is that right?
Yes. The Canadians.
Or any other teams that you guys...
The Canadians and the Ducks were our first teams last year. We just launched the program 2 seasons ago. The first season, we did not offer it to any teams. We actually went out and did our work and populated the program with information. And then last year, it was our first year where we had clubs that were using it. And the Ducks and the Canadians were the first two teams that used it last year. And we're talking with clubs now, one of them the Sharks, and with the hope that more clubs are going to use it this year. And we think that's probably, you know, probably a good bet that that's going to happen.
In that article, it mentioned something called the Team 33 value score. And for the listeners, it's kind of, from what I can tell, and you might be able to explain a little better, like an all-encompassing score attributed to each player that incorporates their performance, scouting reports, their age, their salary, injury, progression curve, a whole lot of things, and then kind of puts out a number. Can you talk a little bit about that process, how that came about, and is that something that you guys still use?
Yes. It's something actually very unique, and allows us to do a lot of things in the program. So every player, every draft pick, even future draft pick, has a value. What's really unique about it is, regardless of where the player may be playing, or if it's not even a player yet, it's actually a pick maybe in next year's draft or future drafts, the value that that asset receives is on the same scale. So for instance, if you're looking at a player who's playing in the KHL, you can compare that player to a player playing in college hockey, to another player playing in the NHL or the American Hockey League, and everybody's rating is on the same scale. So you don't have to predict or project what this player playing at a certain level is going to be like if he gets to the NHL. Our Team 33 value does that for you. And it's done in real time. And as you said, there's a number of things that go into the algorithm, such as, you know, players' performance, but also other things, maybe issues that occur off the ice or injuries, particularly serious injuries. It could be the player's contract, and whether it's perceived that he's being paid fair value, again, positively or negatively. All those types of things go into creating the value. And then the value is on a 993 point scale. So if you could imagine, a 993 would be the perfect player, which I'm sure there's guys out there that think they are, but we have none. So
there might be one in history I can think of, just probably one guy.
Yeah, maybe. But right now I can tell you the highest guys that that we have score just over 900. Those would be the top players. And those are qualified as elite players. I mean, our elite players would score from about 850 to 993, and there's probably 25 or 26 of them in the world.
And I guess I have two more questions related to the score before we move on to different parts of the interview, but is it just amateur or pro scouting, or is there amateur scouting as well, before the drafts?
Right now, we only cover pros. We do cover worldwide. Any player who is on an NHL reserve list. So that could include some players that have been drafted but not yet signed to a pro contract. We do have information, and we do provide information on those players. However, I'm actually working right now with junior and college coaches. In particular, I'm working with Ted Donato and Jim Tortorella, John Tortorella's brother, at Harvard University, and we're developing the amateur program as we speak. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to test the prototype for amateur this season, and then for the 24-25 season, we'll be able to launch it, and the organizations that have our Team 33 program will now also have the amateur program. And I think it'll be a great incentive for those that don't have our program to now to get it, because we'll be covering amateur hockey as well.
Mike, now that you have the program pulled up, can you tell us some of the numbers that might be related to the Sharks, including maybe Erik Karlsson?
Sure. I'll pull up the Sharks.
And just a reminder for listeners, so any player above 850 is considered elite. Typical top six forward will rate around 500, role player at 150. And this score incorporates everything on the ice, scouting reports, salary, age, injury history, progression curve.
All right, so we'll start with Erik Karlsson. Mm-hmm. Erik Karlsson, our program rates him as a 582.
Okay.
Which is, you know, essentially a first pair defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a one or a two defenseman. You know, he's obviously got a big cap hit.
that's putting it nicely.
And that's, you know, and that's going to bring down his score a little bit.
Mm.
You know? I mean, it doesn't mean that he's not a terrific player. In fact, his skating is fantastic. His hockey sense is fantastic. I mean, his score in both of those categories is very high. And those are, you know, in today's game, the two most important scores. I mean, where he suffers a little bit is his physicality. I don't think that's any surprise to anybody. But he's a competitive player and he has a lot of detail to his game. You know, and he still brings a lot of offense. We would classify this guy as a transitional defenseman, meaning, you know, he transitions from defense to offense. I mean, that's his game, right?
100%. Yep.
He's a little bit of a risk reward player.
A little bit.
Yeah. And that means he's a liability in his own end. You know, this guy's one of our scouts calls him an offenseman instead of a defenseman.
I mean, that I don't think anybody would kind of argue that. what player has the maximum score on the Sharks, or is it Karlsson?
You know, I could look through one by one, but I would say it's probably Karlsson.
Okay.
I mean, we can look at a few other guys here just for scores. Actually, Logan Couture scores 584, which is right there with
right him. Around there. Sure.
You know, overall, Logan Couture is not his skating and his hockey sense is a little bit below Karlsson, but again, so is his cap hit. all these things are taken into account, right? Interestingly enough, they're both unrestricted free agents at the end of the 27-28 season. So they're in the same position contractually. Just one guy's cap hits $3.5 million more than the other.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to also ask you too, since you have the program open, just curious, since the Sharks are looking more toward the future, they're rebuilding, any Barracuda prospects kind of stand out as kind of higher in score? You know, you don't have to mention everybody, but just anyone stand out from the CUDA?
Again, I'd have to, you know, look at these guys individually, but if there's a name or two you want to throw at me.
Sure. William Eklund. Yeah, Keegan, yeah. If you've got a name.
Gushchin and Bordalo. I think those three.
Okay.
Okay. So let's do Gushchin first. He's right in front of me. Gushchin right now, his value is 182.
Mm-hmm.
Now that means he's, you know, he's probably a third line player in the future. In fact, that's what we have him as, a third line role player. His skating is above average, but not elite. Same thing with his hockey sense. He's a pretty good, overall offensive player, and he's better than average defensively. Same thing with his competitiveness and his playmaking. He can contribute on the power play and the PK. And he can even hang in there a shootout, but again, he's not a physical player, and that that hurts him. And that seems to be a lot of what I see on the Sharks right now is not a lot of physicality.
Mm. Might be the same for Eklund as well. I mean, he's got a little bit more physicality to him, but.
Did you say Bordalo? Who do you want to see next?
Bordalo and Eklund, I guess.
Okay, let's do Bordalo first. Yeah. And so Bordalo, again, he's a 163.
Mm.
So again,
he's lower than Gushchin. Yeah.
So he's in that same area. their skating and hockey sense are pretty much the same. He's not quite as good a defensive player. He's average, but he's not quite as good, and a little bit less competitive as a player. He will contribute on the power play and a little bit on the penalty kill. But again, his physicality is way down. We have his fit in the organization as a playmaker, but he's a depth scorer and still a future prospect. So his 3-year projection is to be a role player.
Can players, I guess, change their scores kind of over time? I know this is a projection, so this is also accounting for kind of what you guys see their futures as, but like, can that happen where, you know, Thomas Boyle eats his Wheaties this summer and suddenly he's somebody else?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, look, I mean, players have the ability to improve, you know, whether that's, you know, their skills on the ice or their strength. A lot of times, you know, what we see at this level is just their attitude and their willingness to go into tough areas. I mean, a lot of these players, remember, they come up and they're, you know, their top players, whether it be scoring or playmaking, but their top players when it comes to their skill set, either in junior or college or wherever they're coming from. And then, you know, the NHL in particular is a whole different level. And so sometimes if you're Thomas Bortolo, you may have been a guy that could show off your skills at the lower levels, but now you've got to make it in the NHL, you've got to become a third line player. And that, you know, that requires you to do some different things than maybe you were used to doing. And so those players that transition and do those things and maybe become more physical or more willing to go into those hard areas will be successful.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners that the Team 33 value score, that is obviously a numerical, but there's algorithm to that. But this is also vetted from 21 pro scouts who are watching, you know, the different all these different players are watching the Barracuda. And so these scores, I know, are maybe a little depressing for Sharks fans listening now, looking into the future. But let's end off with Willie Mecklin. Then maybe Mike can bring some cheer to Sharks fans right now.
Yeah, Eklund seems to be he scores higher at a 193.
Okay,
and we should mention that these scores aren't static. Mm-hmm. So, for instance. Sure. You know, an elite level player would score above 850, but a first line player would score, you know, about 600 or more. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, there's a 250 point difference, where a lot of players fit between one category to the next. But even more so when you go from the first line down to second through line four, you know, there can be as much as a 400 point difference in our score.
So 100%, yep.
Eklund scores 193, which puts him at the, you know, a second line type player. Mm-hmm. That's what he's projected to be, a second line player. You know, he's a winger, again, not a very big guy, like Bortolo. I mean, he's barely 5'10", if that, not a very heavy guy. Hopefully that improves with your strength and conditioning coach.
The Wheaties.
But you know, again, his skating and hockey sense are in the same area. His offensive ability overall is a little bit better, as is his defensive ability, than say a Bortolo. And he seems to be a much more competitive player. His playmaking ability is higher than the other two, as is his ability to contribute on the power play or the penalty kill. He's also, you know, a little bit better than the other two, actually significantly better as a shootout player. But he lacks physicality. He really does. And that's one of the things he's got to improve.
Sure. And that's something that's been mentioned with Bortolo, and he's, you know, tried to take that to heart through last season and probably this season as well.
Yeah. I think Johnny McCarthy will have a lot to say about these kids for sure.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for this introduction into Team 33. I think you mentioned to me before too that eventually you guys want to go to a subscription platform. So that means that Keegan and myself, we can subscribe, or you guys listening, you guys can subscribe to Team 33 and get these kind of scouting reports and insight from pro scouts, NHL experienced scouts. But moving on though, Mike, one of the big reasons why I wanted to have you on, I wanted to explore a couple of Erik Karlsson scenarios with you from a front office perspective. And obviously with all your front office experience for 20 plus years of it. So right now, at the moment, it appears that the offers for Erik Karlsson, they aren't really moving the needle for the Sharks. On the other hand, though, it's very, very public that Erik wants out from the Sharks. You know, understandably so. You know, he's 33. He wants to win while he still is performing at a high level. So I wanted to talk to you about this hypothetical of Erik Karlsson starting the season off with the Sharks. And just off the top, you know, going back to your front office experience, you know, what are some of the concerns that stand out to you about having a player come back who doesn't really want to be here?
I don't have particular concerns. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, I liken this to when a player files for salary arbitration. Mm-hmm. Okay. And often teams are very careful about what they say to the player in arbitration, like they're going to upset that player for some reason. But the reason I liken it to a salary arbitration system is in the NHL, in 90% of the cases, the player is the one who elects to go to salary arbitration. And in this case with Karlsson, I mean, he's the one that wants to go somewhere else so mm-hmm. he can win. That's great that the Sharks are going to, you know, make that happen at some point. But the Sharks have to think about the Sharks. Because when Erik Karlsson leaves, the Sharks have to be competitive, right? And so I don't think that's a problem. And if it becomes a problem for Erik Karlsson, then I think, and I don't think it will. I mean, what I know about him, I think he's a pro. And I think, he's made his feelings known. I think the Sharks realize that they've got to do the best to build their organization, and they'll wait it out. But I don't want to see the NHL get to be like the NBA. And what I mean by that is, these guys for years, and I know the new CBA is coming out in the NBA and it'll be a little bit different, but, you saw for years these players that's, finally got their big second or third contracts from a place like Oklahoma City, for instance, mm-hmm. right? With all those players they had back in the day, Harden and Durant and Russell and Westbrook. And then, they got the big money, the max they could get. And then they said, okay, now I want to leave. Why? Yeah. Because they knew that team would give it to them, right? Because if they didn't, they'd leave. And then
they lose for nothing, basically.
Then they force them to stay way out of there. And now we're at a point in the NBA where you see, like, for instance, Damian Lillard. He not only wants to leave, but he wants to go to this particular team. Mm-hmm. And so you need to make that happen. And I hope the NHL doesn't go that way. I don't think the NHL will go that way. So I don't see it being a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's been good discussion between, the hockey operations folks, especially Mike Greer and Erik Karlsson and his representatives. And they're going to try to do the best thing for both parties, but the Sharks have to do what's best for the Sharks. I don't know if you remember this, but in Ray Bourque's final year, or final years anyways, with the Bruins.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The same thing pretty much happened. And he thought he was getting traded at the end of the year before, but the trade didn't happen. Mm-hmm. He came back with Boston the next year. He was still the captain of the team. He was a good soldier. There was no internal issue, and it went to the deadline the following year. And all signs pointed that he was going to end up in Philadelphia. And then he ended up in Colorado. And lo and behold, he won a Stanley Cup in Colorado.
Sure. Yeah, rest is history, right?
And he was happy. And the interesting thing, especially as a person from Boston, was he actually spoke to the Bruins and said, I'd like to bring the cup back to Boston when I have my day with it.
And right.
The Bruins had no problem with it. And he did it. And they had a nice celebration and everything was good. So, you know, I think you've got a guy in Carlson who's a pro. Mm-hmm. I know you've got a really good general manager there in Mike Greer and really good people there that both sides will handle this. And I don't think there's going to be any issue if Eric has to start the season or even play a good portion of the season with the Sharks. I think he'll, you know, for himself, he'll want to play his best and for the teammates that he has at the time. And for the opportunity to maybe move somewhere else, he'll want to play well.
Sure, sure. I've spoken with different sources, league sources, agents, team executives about this sort of issue, so to speak. And one thing that does come out that I've heard a couple places is that there is a, you know, there can be, you know, maybe I'm not necessarily with Eric, there can be an issue of a buy-in from a player that doesn't want to be there and how that affects the room. Obviously too, the risk are too injury, right? Eric Carlson can get hurt or it can be a decline in performance. But I guess I wanted to ask you in general though, about past situations and what we can learn from that. And if, you know, things like buy-in are a concern, and actually a situation that you were kind of involved in, Alexei Yashin in Ottawa had the same situation kind of where he wanted out and they kept him until the next year. And eventually he was traded to the New York Islanders who you were working for at the time. And then more recently, we have Matt Duchene in Colorado, same kind of situation. And in the Colorado held on to him and traded him the next year. But anyway, just from past situations, you know, obviously it worked out for Ray Bourque in Boston. So a lot of it seems to depend on how professional the player himself is. But you know, any sort of thought on that, on just sort of what we can learn from past historical examples.
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's a big difference between one situation to the next.
Sure.
And, you know, in this case with Carlson, the situation's about him wanting to, you know, move on to a team that's, you know, going to challenge to win the Stanley Cup. He doesn't feel like San Jose's there right now. And the Sharks are looking to, you know, do the best they can for the organization so they can, you know, be a Stanley Cup contender, you know, as soon as possible. But when you look at other situations, the difference is those situations are often contractual situations. Carlson's situation is not a contract. He gets paid very well. He agreed to that contract. I'm guessing, you know, it was easy for him to agree to that contract given the amount he's being paid. And so, you know, he has an obligation to honor that contract and earn that money that that he's going to be paid. A lot of situations, you bring the Yashin situation back, and boy, that really goes back into my memory. Mm. But the situation in Ottawa with Yashin was contractual.
Mm. Right, he wanted a raise, I believe, right?
Yeah, he wanted a big raise, and he got one when he got to the Islanders. But that was a different situation, and one where the player, you know, didn't want to play because it really wasn't worth it for him to play.
Sure.
But in Carlson's situation, it's not worth it for him not to play. Mm. I mean, that's a lot of money. And, you know, injury could happen at any time in any situation.
Sure.
But I don't think any player, you know, goes in and thinks about that. If they do, that's when they're going to get hurt. You know, it's the risk. It's the risk you take. But I think that's the biggest difference when you look at these different situations. Is it a contractual situation or is the player, you know, got a nice contract and he just wants to get to a place where he can win?
Yeah. And it just to kind of go off what you're saying, that it's, you know, obviously worth it. You know, Eric Carlson, 11.5 million AAV. He's the highest paid defenseman in the league. So that it's definitely worth it for him to play. And it's not worth it for him to not perform right up to his value. But one more question off of this too. And I'll say that I'm on the side of, I've been consistently this summer saying that I think that the Sharks should trade Carlson this summer, just get the best that they can this summer and kind of move on from it. But I do want to mention this, that and you know, the fans know this too, that there is a big payoff here, possibly. Yashin and Duchesne, their teams, Ottawa and Colorado, waited it out. Obviously, Ottawa got the pick that would be Jason Spezza and Zdeno Chara, and Colorado got Sam Girard and a pick that would be Bowen Byram. So there is sort of there is a possible big payoff here, though it should be mentioned that they are much younger, and they were Yashin and Duchesne were much younger and less injury prone than Carlson when they were finally dealt. But just Mike, just a question for you here is just that, you know, you seem to be on the side of the Sharks should hold out and just wait for the best package, even run the risk of taking Carlson into the season and just come what may into the next trade deadline.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Carlson's made his wishes known, but the Sharks have to do what's best for the Sharks. Mm-hmm. I really do. You know, and this is a situation where, again, as you mentioned, he's the highest paid defenseman in the league. $11.5 million, that's not an easy hit to your salary cap. You know, that's mm-hmm. going to be, I don't know, 13-14% of your salary cap in one player. So, you know, there are not a lot of teams that can make that deal and add him, sure. Especially teams that are, you know, going to be the top competitors for to win the Stanley Cup. Like, those teams are usually the teams that are up there pretty high in the cap. So I think that it's really smart for the Sharks to be patient. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe a year from now, you know, I'd have to look at teams' rosters and their payrolls. But some other teams, you know, at that time, maybe lose, you know, they may lose some money from their cap, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden they can become suitors.
Sure.
So maybe there's a pool of two or three teams now. Maybe, you know, next year at the end of the season, that pool becomes six or seven teams. And so,
right. And the cap is supposed to go up too.
Right. It's, you know, you never want to be in a position where there's only, you know, where there's only one team.
Right.
And you never want to be in a position where the player not only wants out, but then also tries to control where he goes. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. that's the NBA situation. And I think that's ugly for the NBA, for teams, for fans. You know, when the guy says, I want to trade. Thanks for the big contract. I want to trade, and here's where I want to go. You know, I want to go where they sell lots of suntan lotion and have. And a big night, you know. So I don't know if I'm taking a side here because I don't think Carlson's like that, or at least hasn't been like that so far. Mm-hmm. I just think the Sharks have to be patient and make the right deal. And I mean, I keep talking about the NBA, but look at, you know, the Brooklyn Nets. I mean, they, you know, they were patient with Kevin Durant mm-hmm. last year. They thought they were going to trade him last summer. They ended up trading him in the late winter, right? Like those mm-hmm. kind of things.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was great in Brooklyn too before he got traded.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think he was a problem there, which was great. I don't anticipate that'll be a problem for the Sharks, but I do know that $11.5 million is a lot of money for any team to take on its cap. And especially if you're going to try to give them to a team that thinks they can win the cup.
Okay. I have one more Carlson scenario for you, slightly different, definitely crazier. As we know, Eric has 4 years, $11.5 million AAV. But looking at the details of his contract, it's actually very interesting that he's actually only in big quotes, he's only owed $39 million over the next 4 years. That works out to a $9.75 million a year average, and so that is significantly less than his AAV. And so I wonder, you know, there was a rumor out there reported by Frank Saravalli that the Penguins would be willing to take on Carlson at 20% retainment. And 20% retainment is about $9.5 million a year. So the problem for the Sharks there is that the Penguins don't sound like they're willing to offer much on top of that. You know, the Sharks' reward there is just getting Carlson's contract mostly off the books with very low retention. And that sort of generally seems to be, at least at the moment, the interest in Carlson right now, fair or not, you know, but that is sort of what the market is saying about Carlson right now. And so I wonder, in my sort of wild scenario, Mike, just is this feasible at all that Carlson has a deal kind of, you know, he makes a deal with the Penguins that, okay, I will sign for you for 4 years, say $39 million. So he's made whole. He doesn't lose a cent of cash in this deal, right? And he and the Sharks agree to terminate the contract, and which makes Carlson a free agent, but he has this deal with the Penguins, you know, kind of already completed. And I know that's a wild scenario, but it's been brought up to me, and it makes sense in some kind of ways. And there is some minor precedent for it this summer with Philippe Zadina, who walked away from $4.56 million, not $39 million, but $4.56 million cash from the Detroit Red Wings and signed with the Sharks for just 1 year, $1.1 million. But if Carlson is made whole in something like this, is this something that is, you know, conceivable? Because at least for the Sharks here, you get totally off the hook of Carlson's contract, and Carlson gets to go where he wants, and he doesn't lose any cash.
Well, I think there's a lot too much at play there.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you're telling me that Carlson wants to go and, you know, compete for a Stanley Cup team. Well, I know there's an aging Crosby and Malkin in Pittsburgh, but are they really a top competitor for the Stanley Cup?
No, but they're better than the Sharks, though.
Well, but really they're not, because they didn't make the playoffs last year either, right?
And true.
At least the Sharks got a nice big lottery pick for their season.
Yeah.
So that's part of the game. The other part of it is, you know, if you're the Sharks, I don't think they should have to pay for somebody else's cap issues. You know, if that makes sense. In other words, why should they have to jump through hoops so Carlson can go, you know, where he wants to go, and it makes it work for another team's salary cap problems?
Well, they get the whole contract out the books, though, because the talk is that the Sharks will have to retain a significant amount to move Carlson, be it, you know, 20%, which is sort of what it seems to be right now. And, you know, upwards, obviously, the max for retention is 50%. So in this scenario, you wash your hands completely of Carlson's contract, which is you know, cap space, right, is pretty much the most valuable thing these days.
Yeah, but I mean, do the Sharks have a cap problem right now?
No, they don't.
Yeah. So I don't, again, I don't think the Sharks should worry about, you know, other teams' cap space. I think the Sharks need to make a deal in which they get the right assets back.
Okay.
Whether that's prospects, draft picks, you know, hopefully both for their sake, for this type of player. I mean, this is, you know, I know he's primarily an offensive player, but he is the highest played defenseman in the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's an all-star player. There's no doubt about it. And so, you know, they should fetch something for him that helps their organization be successful in the future more than just, you know, getting the contract off their books.
Okay.
Because my other thought is, what if Carlson didn't want to leave?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Would the Sharks want to move him? I mean, they had a chance to move him last year. He wasn't the guy they chose to move, right? I mean, so
they, it might be the one thing that's kind of putting butts in seats for right now, is to be honest, is Carlson.
Yeah, it could be. But one of the few things. I think this, again, we started this conversation. This is the Sharks' best chip right now for building their future. And so they need to maximize their return. And that means more than, you know, clearing cap space and getting this contract off the books.
And how do you predict this whole thing shakes out? Do you think it ends this summer? Do you think it ends during the season?
I think they'll probably make a deal before training camp starts. Okay. I really do. And like you, I hear Pittsburgh, but there might be somebody else, I think, that could pop up and get involved in this. And it sounds to me like Pittsburgh's trying to be cute here and trying to get a steal of a deal. And if the Sharks are patient, I think there'd be another opportunity. And if there's not, once they get into training camp, I just move along. I mean, the big Joe Thornton trade happened, I think, in November.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, and that was a situation back in the day where, you know, Joe wanted out of Boston. There was no doubt about that. But he hung in there until they were able to make the right deal for both teams.
Well, this is a great segue because go ahead.
No, I was going to say Sharks got the player that they wanted in the end, and you know, it all worked out for the Sharks. So maybe patience is best.
Well, maybe not so much for Boston, but speaking of that,
they won the cup, and they did win eventually.
Yes, but you know, yeah, it's a great segue into sort of the last part of the conversation here. And Mike, thank you again so much for your time and your insight. I'm a big kind of alternate history nerd, and you mentioned Joe Thornton here, and fans love to hear about stuff like this. So, in all your front office experience, Islanders, Predators, Panthers, any sort of Sharks trades almost happened that you heard of or with those teams that you're with?
I don't remember any almost Sharks trades that I was involved in. I don't know why. I mean, honestly, the only time I remember even being in a discussion with the Sharks about any kind of deal was way back when, and it was Patrick Marleau's draft year.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I was with the Islanders, and we were trying to get the draft was in. I remember the draft being in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what year that was.
97.
But we were trying to find a way to move around to see if we could somehow snag Marleau, but we couldn't get it done. We were probably, I'm sure, one of many teams that were trying to get into that spot. Did he go two?
Yeah, he went two. Yeah. If I recall, the Islanders were five, and you guys got the Luongo at five.
Yeah, I think we had four and five.
Four and five.
And we took Brewer and Luongo.
Well, let me ask you. Do you remember? Did you offer four and five to San Jose for two?
I don't remember what the trade was. I mean, there's a perfect example. When I was with the Islanders at that time, we stored draft picks, and you know, there were many years where we had two, three, and first round picks, and sometimes we'd have a couple early second round picks. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember what we would have offered. But we weren't able to get up to that spot to get Marleau.
Right. Well, that's some fun alternate history. The Islanders drafting Marleau at number two. I assume that in any deal, at least one of four or five would be going back to the Sharks and in some other stuff. And so who the Sharks draft at number four or five? Roberto Luongo, maybe, who obviously had a pretty good career himself.
Who knows, right? I mean, it was interesting. It was interesting. But, that's probably the only almost Sharks deal that I guess I can remember. And it really wasn't a Sharks player yet. It was for that second overall pick. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any other almost deals. I happened to be scouting the game in Dallas when the Sharks made the trade for Thornton.
Oh, okay.
With Boston, which was really interesting because we were all in the press box and all of a sudden, we're looking on the ice in warm-up, and the Sharks had about 10 guys out there, it seemed.
Well, they had players who had gone up to the press box had to play. Jim Fahey, Nico Dimitrakos, right? They were actually up there in the press box. So did you see them? And then the next second, they were gone.
Yeah, everything was going on, and we were looking on the ice. And I think there was actually I'm trying to remember who it was. But there was actually somebody, maybe even two guys that went off the ice from warm-up. Like they get on a couple laps.
Probably Sturm and Stewart.
I think that's who it was. I think it was both Stewart and Marco Sturm.
Yeah.
But it was, I remember everybody, the press box was buzzing. Everybody was like, oh, they must make the deal. Who they make it with? You know what I mean?
So. That's awesome. Actually, you know, since you were working at front offices at the time, I actually want to sort of get your recollection of the Thornton trade. There's a perception there that Boston did not really, maximize their return for Jumbo there. Maybe didn't check in with all the teams. and I just wonder, what is your memory of that and sort of how Thornton landed in San Jose?
I mean, I don't recall that, you know, Boston didn't reach out to who they ought to reach out with. I mean, it was a little bit of a different time.
Sure.
Especially when it came to, you know, salary, you know, not having to worry about salary caps and contracts. I do remember Thornton was the first entry-level contract that had this crazy bonus structure where if you achieved one or two bonuses, you got all six or seven bonuses paid and things like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. That was a crazy thing at the time. But, you know, a lot of times people don't understand what was behind the trade and some of the pressures that that different hockey departments feel internally. I mean, like I can tell you, I mean, everybody looks at the trade that you mentioned earlier when I was working for the Islanders, which was Chara, McCault, and a draft pick for Alexi Yashin.
Yeah.
And everybody says, well, oh, the, you know, Zdeno Chara, you know, what a steal that was. Well, if you really look at the trade, Zdeno Chara only stayed with Ottawa for a couple of years and then he was a free agent and he was gone. Mm-hmm. And, at the time the Islanders had just been, sold to Charles Wong, new owner. And, previous to that, our payroll restrictions were $14-15 million a year by our previous owner.
Right, and the Rangers were spending like $60 million, right?
Oh yeah, and Rangers, the Red Wings were too.
Yeah,
and so all of a sudden, Charles Wong came in and said, "I'm going to give you a payroll, but I expect you to win."
Yeah,
and so you know the other thing people don't realize is that Yashin was available. We knew it was a hefty price. The Bill McCault, and you know, unfortunately, he's a great guy, but he had a really bad shoulder injury and never really played much after that. Mm-hmm. His career pretty much, I think, was over within a year or two. He was a lower line forward anyway, out of the University of Michigan. But we knew we were giving up a big prospect in Chara, but one thing that no people realize, well, I don't think people realize, is that the other guy that was holding out at that time and that we also acquired the same day in a trade.
Sure, Michael Pekka, right?
Michael Pekka.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
And people don't realize that it was, I think, three times in 4 years before that Ottawa and Buffalo matched up in the playoffs and Pekka shut down Yashin. I mean, Yashin was a leading scorer in the league every year, and Pekka was shut him down in the playoffs, and Ottawa were getting knocked out. So we looked at that and we said, okay, if we can get Yashin and we can get the second line center that used to check him and shut him down, we're going to be okay.
Yep.
And we actually acquired those two guys. And we made the playoffs that year for the first time in, I think, 12 or 13 years. And we started the season. I want to say we started the season 8 or 9-0 and ended up playing the Red Wings, who were also undefeated at the same time. It was like an unbelievable game. And we ended up losing that year in 7 games to Toronto in the first round. But, again, a couple of years later, Char is in Boston. So, it's easy to sit there and say, you know, oh, wow, what a stupid trade. But if you really look at the facts of how it all evolved, it really wasn't a bad trade at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense. Indeed. I mean, Yashin was in his prime. He's a center, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of pressure. Obviously, teams like Buffalo who haven't made the playoffs in like 10, 11 years, something like that, that are like itching to get back in kind of thing. There's a lot of pressure, especially when you get a new owner that does that, you can actually spend your money kind of thing.
Right. And Yashin had a very famous model actress girlfriend who lived in Long Island named Carol Alt.
Sure, sure, sure.
Well, that all worked out well, too.
Well, Mike, last question for me, last history question for me here, and then Keegan's got one more for you, and then we'll send you on your way. I just wonder, in your time in the front office, just what was the perception of the Sharks and their front office? You know, you dealt with Dean Lombardi's regime and then Doug Wilson's regime. Just any big difference stand out in how the two operated, or, you know, was it pretty, you know, kind of smooth when that transition happened?
Well, I remember when the Sharks first came into the league and they actually had a three-headed GM.
Dean Lombardi, Grillo, and the third guy?
Jack Ferreira and Chuck. Yeah, Jack Ferreira, Chuck Grillo, and Dean Lombardi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously I have a great respect for Jack. I've known him a long time, and I thought he was terrific, you know, in that role. And, you know, Dean was really a scouting guy, right? Mm-hmm. And he was a real good guy at evaluating talent and scouting, which is what you want at that time. Jack had the management experience, and Dean was really an up-and-coming guy at that time.
Sure.
Really bright guy. Still one of the guys that I admire probably the most, one of the guys I admire the most in the sport as a general manager. Like, what he did in LA was fantastic. I mean, he took an organization with the Kings that, you know, for 40 years really did nothing, even with Wayne Gretzky. I mean, they had the one run to the finals.
Sure.
But he built a heck of an organization, won a couple of Stanley Cups, and then unfortunately had a goalie, an all-star goalie that got hurt, and they missed the playoffs in 1 year, and he was out the door. But they did a great job there. But as far as my perspective of that, I thought the Sharks did a really good job of putting the right front office people together to build their organization. I mean, I know that first year was rough, and I remember watching games with Link Gates patrolling the ice and some of the things that happened at the Cow Palace and all that kind of stuff. But they really had a plan, and they were willing willing to do what they needed to do, draft well, and build their organization the right way. And I think they did that. Well, I know they did that. Unfortunately, they didn't win a cup.
Right.
But they were a top contending team for a long time. And then, you know, from those three to move on to Doug Wilson, I mean, he gave them stability. Mm-hmm. I mean, there aren't too many NHL clubs that have a general manager that stays in place that long. And the way you stay in place that long is by being successful.
But being competitive the whole time.
And that Thornton trade that we talked about earlier was really the cornerstone, right, for that team being a top team for a decade or more. So, I nothing but respect for those guys. I know, I mean, Joe Will, who's been there since the beginning, I know Joe well. He's a great, great person, and he's done everything the organization's asked for him to do at different times. You know, Timmy Burke, who's been around there forever too, another Boston guy who I know well, another guy that's done a really good job of finding players and talent for them through the years. And Mike Greer, I think a good young guy who obviously played for the organization, knows what it's all about out there. And I don't think a lot of hockey fans understand how passionate that fan base is about the team. Mm. I mean, that atmosphere in that building, especially when the team was going well. I mean, we ran into them in the playoffs when I was in Nashville, and that was a passionate fan base, and what a fun place to go and play. except for the fact that they make us, the visiting management staff, walk out on that catwalk.
Hang
over the ice and a piece of plywood. I never knew what that was all about, but I'll find out one day.
No, it's Jack told me that what is now the SAP Center was originally supposed to be a basketball arena, and of course, a basketball press box is, you know, is you know, maybe courtside or whatever. So they didn't really plan on a regular press box, and then when it became a hockey arena, it's like, well, we don't really have space, so we'll put you with Phantom of the Opera.
And Mike, I just wanted to say thank you for joining us for the better part of an hour. You mentioned earlier that there's going to be a Team 33 subscription service kind of thing. Is that a future reality or a somewhat close reality kind of thing?
That's in the future. I mean, I don't think it's something we'll have ready for this season. By next season for sure.
Sure.
But yeah, that's our goal, is actually to turn this eventually into a web-based program that, you know, folks like yourself, fans, anybody that, you know, wants, you know, or follows a team in particular and wants more information about players can get it from real pros. I mean, that's real experienced people. I think that's something that's missing out there. We all know with the way things are going now, there's plenty of shows with odds makers and all that type of stuff.
Right.
But what makes us unique is our staff are all former NHL players, GMs, coaches, scouts. I mean, they're people that really know what they're looking at and really know what they're evaluating, not only on the ice, but, you know, contractually and all the other things that go with it. So,
yeah. It's always been kind of a like a big, you know, curtain between like professional scouting services and the fans. It always feels like they kind of protect their information really, really to their chest. I mean, it is how they make their money, but it's interesting to see if there's something out there that fans could read.
Yeah. And you know what? And they should, the teams should protect their information, but we're not in the league. So
you're independent.
Team 33.
Yeah, exactly. Our guys can tell you what they think. And, you know, one of the nice things about the program is we're able to employ guys that at least currently aren't working in the league, and it gives them a chance to continue to, you know, to do what they do best. And then we've had a couple of guys already in the 2 years that we've been out here who hook on with teams, you know, the following year. We have other guys that fall out from teams, maybe their contracts expire, and we add them to the staff for the year. So it's become a good place for scouts and managers and people like that to go while they're in between jobs.
Thank you so much again, Mike, for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
This was a pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
All right, thank you.
Maybe after Carlson gets traded, whenever that is.
Yeah, come on in. We'll do a recap show right afterwards. We can evaluate how well they did based on your system.
Yeah.
Well, we can do that. We can definitely do that once the deal is done, for sure. I might even fly to San Jose for that one. Do it in person. It must be a good place where we can bring all the fans in and do it live.
Mm-hmm. Yep, live show. That sounds good to me.
All right, guys. Absolutely. Thanks very much.
All right. Take it easy, Mike.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.